Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Squawk Pod. You'll get interviews and behind-the-scenes access. Look for us on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today on Squawk Pod. Bill Gates, world's biggest taxpayer.
I've paid over $10 billion in taxes. I paid more than anyone in taxes.
The second richest man, pretty good person to ask about the wealth debate. Pulitzer Prize winner Tom Friedman on high stakes in the trade war.
A senior Chinese official said to me, "Mr. Friedman, you're too late. We're too big."
And dine-in promiscuity. How do you like your delivery?
I do hold the croutons, but actually it comes with Parmesan chips.
Andrew, Joe, and Melissa Lee ask the CEO of Postmates what's on the menu.
Taco Bell.
Grubhub is Taco Bell.
Those stories and more.
Let's get the billionaires. Let's get them all. Let's storm the gates.
I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Thursday, November 7th, 2019. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Andrew by. Up and Andrew. Here.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Joe Kernan and Melissa Lee, who's hanging out with us this morning. Is this the first time
on the new
on
set?
The new set here with us? Becky's got the day off.
Thrilling.
It's thrilling so
yes.
far. It's thrilling 1 minute into the show.
1 minute.
1 minute and it's thrilling.
You know what?
Call her
Let's
in 3 hours.
That she meant that. You meant that totally seriously.
I meant that seriously.
She meant that seriously and genuinely.
First up on today's podcast, breaking news overnight. China's Commerce Ministry announced that the U.S. and China have agreed to roll back the tariffs that were imposed during the trade war in phases. There's no timetable or location planned for a deal signing, at least not yet. Here's Joe.
China trade comments du jour.
And yep. The du jour is the, yes.
Yesterday, the du jour comment was, you know, that we won't be ready for Brazil or whatever, wherever they were thinking.
Nothing till December.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we were up 80 and we go to zero. So, I mean, think about that.
It can flip around
really
pretty
basis
quick.
Points on really the averages. And today it's up, but it's still it's not a percent. So.
But it's up close to record
but
highs.
But it is. We're
maintaining that neighborhood of record highs.
New York Knicks owner Jim Dolan is reportedly being encouraged to sell stakes in the
Wow, I've not heard that from Andrew ever.
This is good news. I know we're not supposed to editorialize, but this is the best.
Have you ever heard Andrew howl like that?
Never.
I grew up with the Knicks.
You know we're talking about sports.
It's been devastating. Devastating. I grew up, I mean, I was a Patrick Ewing Knicks fan, and this has been just a treacherous.
You know what? I can
like,
identify
decades,
with you.
Decades.
I can identify with you because of Mike Brown in Cincinnati owning the Bengals. Anyway, as well as the New York Rangers. So you think both could benefit from...
Possibly. The Rangers are actually done okay, but yeah.
They have, although I don't know any of the Rangers anymore.
That's true.
Got rid of everyone. The New York Post says that activist and investor Cliff Robbins trying to get Madison Square Garden CEO Dolan to find minority buyers for the teams in advance of a separation of MSG Sports properties from other assets. Robbins reportedly said the Knicks and Rangers could be worth more than $7 billion instead of a valuation that Forbes has, it's pegged at about $5.5 billion. We've had Cliff on.
We've had Cliff, of course. I don't know if this is doable is the real issue, though. By the way, the other thing, you know, Cliff has always been an activist investor, but, you know, what do they say, nice activist, meaning?
Friendly.
Friendly activist. So I don't know how far he can push this. The Dolans obviously control the company.
But from a fan standpoint, why does this matter, who owns it?
Why does it matter? Have you not seen what... It's going on. Have you
There's
seen the Knicks in the
ways.
Last
a lot of
two decades?
There's a lot of different ways to run a team, and it might not include winning.
I mean, there's no winning. No, I mean,
oh, I understand
Phil
that there's
Jackson's
no winning.
Everybody's coming. There's like musical chairs.
Because like they're not hiring the right coaches and all that.
They're moving the deck chairs around the Titanic.
You do have to. I mean, it's a weird combination of spending enough money but knowing how to spend the money in the right way, get the right people, not only the players but also.
So this could be good for MSG,
motivation.
The stock.
Could be good for the stock. Could be good for the city.
How long has it been?
Could be good for the NBA. By the way, the other owners in the NBA have for so long wanted the Knicks to do well because it would help everything.
Right.
Anyway.
All right.
But this could be fascinating news.
You woo. And
I'm not supposed to
I know.
Root. I'm
you
not supposed woo. To root. Am I supposed to root for an activist investor? This is sort of an interesting situation. In this case, I might have to root for
I'd
him.
I'd just like to see you excited about. Can I get you on DraftKings with me? So we can. You want me to show you how to do it? You get in, you know, right before the show starts.
Yep.
So I did not really get to talk to you enough about yesterday. And because I, you know, we're on the air, we don't, you know, commercial breaks are so short. I think we need to, what was the lead? What happened yesterday? What can you tell me? Give me something.
I'll be honest, we'll talk about it. I will say it felt magical. There were all sorts of fascinating things.
If you do say so yourself.
It was tremendous.
I saw that picture yesterday of you walking by, that sign of you, that really good, where you look really like a great.
Was there? Great?
You saw that. You tweeted it. It was beautiful. You were walking by and it says Deal Book, yes. Founder.
It's an electronic screen. They changed.
Oh, is it electronic?
It changes.
That was major. Changes. For me, major. I'm starting to realize who I'm dealing with here.
Another day, another billionaire crossing swords with presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren. This time, at the New York Times Dealbook Conference hosted by our Andrew Ross Sorkin, it was the world's second richest man.
Billionaire Microsoft founder Bill Gates drawing the attention of Senator Elizabeth Warren. This after a comment that he made yesterday with me at the New York Times Dealbook Conference.
I've paid over $10 billion in taxes. I paid more than anyone in taxes, but I, you know, I'm glad to have paid, you know, if I'd had to pay $20 billion, it's fine. But, you know, when you say I should pay $100 billion, okay, then I'm starting to do a little math about what I have left over. Sorry, I'm just kidding. So you really want the incentive system to be there, and you can go a long ways without threatening that.
Have you ever talked to Elizabeth Warren about any of
this
not. Before? Would you? Would you want to?
You know, I'm not sure how open-minded she is. Or that she'd even be willing to sit down with somebody, you know, who has large amounts of money.
Well, we might be brokering the peace here because now Senator Warren says she would be willing to meet with Bill Gates. She tweeted last night, "I'm always happy to meet with people, even if we have different views. Bill Gates, if we get the chance, I'd love to explain exactly how much you'd pay under my wealth tax. I promise it's not $100 billion. Some others, by the way, have done the math. On an annual basis, it would be an additional probably $6 billion on his current wealth, depending on...
Including the capital gains piece of the wealth tax?
It might be he might be paying total of a $12 billion, mm-hmm. But it sounds to me like he already may be paying close to $6 billion as it is on an annual basis. So it would be an additional $6 billion, give or take a couple billion here or there. You know, what's so interesting about Bill Gates is he does, and he's a big advocate for all sorts of progressive tax systems and talks about bringing the estate tax, but doing all sorts of things. But when it comes to the wealth tax itself, at that 6% level, I think he has a bit of a different view. And I don't think it's... out of some effort to save his own money. I think it's a philosophical view.
That's what I was saying. I'm not even close. I know it's a shock to you, but I'm not even close to a billionaire. So, and I have spent a lot of time, you know, sort of defending that position. Right. And, you know, I see the way that it's portrayed on, you know, certain venues recently, you know, comedy. They're joking about it. I get that. But, you know, I'm not sticking my neck out. Why should I philosophically defend that when all you're going to be is the target of a class warfare argument? So forget it. Here's my only problem, Andrew. I just don't want to look at people like Gates or Lee Cooperman or any of these people as a negative to society. We all have to decide whether it really is a zero-sum game or whether you can actually create wealth and do some really great things in your life.
And
so I think Bill Gates... I look at that $10 billion that he pays, and I think that is really, really great that this man in his life is in a position to pay $10 billion in taxes that can be used for all the things that we want to try to do. I don't think he stole $10 billion that you would divvy it up between all the people that are unable to have that $10 billion because he has the $10 billion. Right. I don't think it's a zero-sum game. And that's the mentality that really drives me crazy. And that's not even including... philanthropic efforts of a Bill Gates or a Lee Cooperman. Think about what these guys do just in taxes, what they pay, what the employees that many of them generated the jobs that the employees have, the taxes that they pay, the right. shareholders that are that pay taxes, you know, maybe not enough, but think of all the, and then throw on that the giving pledge Lee Cooperman right. signed, or and now they're the object of all this derision and what he's crying about his money. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the clip.
Yeah, but well, of course
it's totally skewed and it's not fair and it's funny, but. Hey, count me out, man. I'm not ending up on any clip. Look, let's get the billionaires. Let's get them all.
So interesting.
I'm
so,
with you. Let's storm the gates. Do whatever you need
with,
to do.
You're not with me.
Turn them upside down.
I said like yesterday when I was introducing Bill Gates. Bill Gates to me is the most consequential individual, singularly,
but there are,
of
but
our entire of this entire era, both in terms of what he did in the private sector.
It could be him.
And what he did in the public sector.
It could be any. It could be Druckenmiller. Any of these guys that do right. all this incredible stuff. In addition to paying huge right. tax bills
and that, but
through their career.
But one of the things that I would say, and I think this is true of what Bill was saying yesterday, is there is all sorts of other low-hanging fruit that could be. And I think pushing back for as long as I think the pushback over time against raising capital gains, against carried interest, against all of these other things along the way has created this time and this moment. Meaning, I think, frankly, from a quote fairness perspective, had some of these things that just seem so out of whack been dealt with, I don't think we'd be dealing with these ideas which now seem
so extreme. You mean if we've been taxing all along, we wouldn't have this point in time where people are demanding higher wealth taxes?
There's never enough.
No. I don't think it's never enough. I think if you look at...
Can we talk about what we're going to spend it on? We haven't said a word about whether we're going to spend this...
Look, I'm not an advocate of the wealth tax. I would tell you, by the way...
No, but why do we spend so much time talking about getting the money when we don't even know how to spend it effectively when we do get it? Why don't... Half the discussion should be about how we
100%.
Equalize opportunity.
I'm not going to disagree with that.
Huh?
I'm not going to disagree with that.
All right.
But the side that
Elizabeth Warren, I don't know, maybe she does have...
What's so fascinating, did you guys see, there was a piece by Neil Irwin yesterday in the Times that did fascinate me,
the
genuinely.
The Times?
The New York Times.
Because
how he described the wealth tax? As a tax, not like a traditional tax, but like a cigarette tax. Because the goal of the tax is actually there for there to right. be less of it eventually. Right. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, just was a very new way of sort of framing the issue.
And he was in support of that?
No. He was trying to describe this okay. in a new way.
At the New York Times?
At the New York Times, Joe. It's worth reading because it really sort of makes you think about really understanding what the goal of the tax is. Usually the tax is to raise revenue.
Right.
This is to do something that's punitive. Different and more
because
than
they
that.
Will go elsewhere.
Punitive.
All these guys will go elsewhere.
Yep. I just wish we spent half the time really finding effective ways to use that because we blow it now, a lot of it.
That goes to the heart of the argument of all these guys. Why right. should I give my money to the government to spend when I can spend it on my own in self-directed
I get that, but then
rather
the other,
give it to, I'd rather
yes,
give it,
but then the other piece
not
of Bill,
for the write-off either. I don't even care.
But
I'd rather
Bill also
have,
talked about, look, Bill's doing, I think, God's work with a lot of his wealth.
Well, a lot
but
of them are.
Hold on, no. But a lot of money is being used by others for lobbying efforts, for politics. There's all sorts of things going on. And I think he would like to clean that
right.
up, too. And I think part of the problem is there hasn't been an effort to clean up enough of the, as I said, the low-hanging fruit. And now we've gotten to a point where now there's a larger
You don't want to get in the business of regulating how people use their philanthropic. You know, I don't want virtue
or use their
me
money,
how to use
period.
My philanthropic efforts. Oh, no, that's not a good way for you to. I don't like that cause.
I would just suggest to you that certain 501c3s
right,
are masquerading as
Look,
other...
There's always an exception, though. There's always
that's what I say about the Clinton Foundation. I don't want it used for private jets for all the people that are running the thing. All right. So, but don't tell me my cause isn't as worthy as yours. Then you're getting another slippery slope because our causes are totally different. I think. Except the cause of Squawk Box and promoting that.
Except the cause of Squawk Box. We have to promote it, and we have to get some advertising dollars right now.
Right, Kyle.
Kyle on the camera.
Coming up. What's coming up, Kyle?
Coming up. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Tom Friedman.
Oh, you're talking to me?
On China's economic rise.
They sold us shallow goods. Clothes we wore on our back, shoes we put on our feet, solar panels we put on our homes.
And the race for the White House.
The overwhelming political fact in America today is that more than half of Americans feel they don't have a candidate they're excited about.
Squawk Pod. We'll be right back. This is Squawk Pod.
Was I fat?
Three, two,
Sorry, push on Joe. Up on him, cue.
I got to soften
we're
him
on
up.
TV
we're
now,
on TV
now,
Joe.
We're on TV now. I got to soften
Tom
him up.
Friedman's before, Tom Friedman's here.
Before we start. Before we start.
Said I look thin. I like this guy. U.S. equity futures jumping after China's commerce. You got to breathe, though. Commerce Ministry said the U.S. and China have agreed to phase out the tariffs that were imposed during the trade war. Let's welcome our special guest, Tom Friedman. Can we dress like this? Do you think we can?
I think this is a great look he's got.
I know, but why we could pull this off. I mean, he's a New York Times foreign affairs columnist, Pulitzer winner, author of Thank You for Being Late. Maybe that's why he gets the license to dress like that. We still need to try a little harder. Maybe.
You could for pull up a turtleneck.
You got to switch it up, guys. You got to switch it up.
Tom, we've always known that there was an election coming, and we've always worried that political expediency would perhaps allow us to not, once we've started to pursue this track, as long as we've gotten this far, shouldn't we really get some substantive things? What you're seeing now, are we giving up the possibility of really getting some real action just because we need to do it as November approaches? China. Are we doing something now, just accepting a half measures to get something done? Or is it possible that we get something on IP and some of the things, the egregious things we want to accomplish?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen the deal yet. You know, so it's hard to know exactly. It was never all going to be done in one fell swoop. The problems were too big, and China's too powerful. You know, I still want to see the details, Joe, but something we've talked about before, because I was there 2 years ago and part of a dialogue on this whole issue, and I'm a hardliner on this. I believe we did have to take this on. And for three reasons, basically. You know, China went from poverty to middle income, I think using a three-silo strategy. First silo was hard work, smart investments in infrastructure, smart investments in education, and delayed gratification, silo one. Silo two was stealing others' intellectual property, non-reciprocal trade arrangements, non-compliance with WTO rules, and forced technology transfer.
Okay.
Silo three was the U.S. Pacific fleet. They should have been paying for our presence there because our fleet reassured all of China's neighbors that China could dominate them economically but not geopolitically, which was very important for their economic expansion. If we let them use that same three-silo strategy to go from middle income to high income around AI, machine supercomputers, all these other 5G, we'd be crazy. Someone had to call the game, and it's good that Trump did it. The question now is, you know, how much can you get from them? And I go back to this dialogue I was in there a couple years ago where a senior Chinese official, when I was pushing this hard line, said to me, Joe, Mr. Friedman, you're too late. We're too big. So you got that. That mood is there. Okay. And what Trump did was because he went so far, unlike any previous president, he got their attention. There's no question. But sitting back there is still a huge amount of sense that we don't have to give too much, you know. So I think both sides need this first stage of the deal, Joe. But what I was just in China 2 months ago, and what I heard there was there's a real worry, though, there that if they do stages two and three, which would require real domestic reform by Xi Jinping, where he'd have to really take some meat out of the state-owned industries, they're worried that Trump is so unstable as a political character that if he got close to the election and he needed to juice his base, he could turn over the whole table. So I think that's really the tension there between the short term and the long term.
In your view, and I've tried to figure this out, what was Trump's initial motivation for taking on such a difficult thing? When I think of most conventional politicians as being...
Yeah, risk averse.
And self-interest.
Yeah.
And something that's going to benefit their political fortunes. And I can't figure out, I can't connect the dots to where this would be helping Trump. Maybe it does with his base. Is that why he did it originally? Well, did he know it would play with nationalist, populist sentiment and all the job losses?
Well, in a way, it cut across because on the one hand, it would play with some standing up for America in the way previous both Republican and Democratic presidents have not done so aggressively. But it hurt his base in rural America. It certainly took a lot of pain. I think he's, as I've listened to him and studied him, he's had a long history of this, feeling this about Japan and about China. And on this issue, I have to give him credit that he basically said, no one else would have done this but me.
I think that might be.
And I think it's true.
That's where I wonder, all just to be thrown away at the end because he has to do it.
Right.
I'm
worried. I want to see the deal, and I haven't seen it yet. And so I'm going to be on the more generous side. Something had to be done. He oversold what you could get, you know, right away, I think, because it's a much harder process. But let's see what the final numbers are. Talking to business people, and a lot of people are worried. Particularly, Joe, in the telecom industry. Hey, what's going to happen to Huawei? Are we going to basically give Huawei a passing? Big concern about that. You know,
but isn't the expectation that'll have to be part of this? I mean,
for China, it's a huge deal. You're talking about their leading technology.
It's the ultimate pawn in the trade war.
But, Andrew, to me, there have always been two issues here. There's been the broader trade question, soybeans and Boeings,
right.
You know, and then there's Huawei. And what Huawei represents is for 30 years, we sold China what I call deep goods, software, computers, stuff that went right. deep into a business or a household. They sold us shallow goods,
yep.
Clothes we wore on our back, shoes we put on our feet, solar panels we put on our homes. What Huawei represents is China is now approaching our technological peer, and they want to sell us deep stuff that right. goes into our sidewalks, into our walls, into our bedrooms. And what we're telling them, we don't have the shared values and trust for us to buy your deep goods. And that's why Huawei is the tip of a very big iceberg that right. is still going to be there no matter what happens in the short
term. So we were talking to Bill Gates yesterday,
yeah.
and he actually has a different view.
I've argued with him about this.
You know about it. His view is that effectively Boeing also has software in their engines, and if we're right. going to sell them planes, we should be willing to accept it on the other side.
Well, you know,
and that the software code can be corrupted both ways.
When we were questioning about does Windows have some NSA thing in it, we gave to governments the Windows source code, and they could look at it, they could compare it to what was shipped. We created an openness that made them comfortable enough, and Huawei can do the same thing.
Well, you know, there is some truth to that in this sense, Andrew. You know, if when I was over in China a couple months ago, I actually Googled Huawei and cyber. You know what the first
from China.
Thing, from China. I don't remember where I was, but and you know what the first thing that comes up? Edward Snowden's testimony that the NSC had hacked Huawei, built a backdoor into Huawei systems so they could do two things. One, penetrate all the countries Huawei had installed their technology in, like Pakistan, and at the same time discover whether Huawei was in fact backed by the PLA, the People's wow. Liberation Army in China. That's actually the first thing that comes up. And so I think Bill's onto something in that is we are going to be so penetrating each other. You can drive yourself crazy around this, or you can just accept that privacy is over.
So Tom Friedman is the foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. But a domestic policy issue that engages just about all, Medicare for all. It's a hot-button issue on the campaign trail for the Democratic nomination, as well as how to pay for it.
You know, I'm not an expert on healthcare or whatever, so I've been trying to read as many analyses as I had. And the one that made the most sense to me was by Larry Summers yesterday in the Washington Post. I mean, a Democrat, I mean, someone who's predisposed to this. And Larry's made a point that a lot of people have made, that the whole plan relies on the most optimistic scenarios of where the economy will go for the next 10 years, the money that can
in
be
in terms
raised.
Of both the taxes
exactly.
and taxes raised and also the costs
exactly.
on the Medicare for All plan.
At both ends of it, number one. And, you know, Larry also pointed out that, you know, the New Deal and the Great Society, you know, we're all actually based on middle class also paying for all these expansions of new programs. So my position, Andrew, I actually liked Obamacare. I thought it was in the right direction. And I think expanding Obamacare by adding a public option that actually would create a government health entity that could actually drive down costs because it would have far fewer costs than private health insurance companies, and going back to taxing young people to make sure everyone's in the program so you have a balanced pool. Why did we just junk that whole program that Democrats fought for and leap to this without saying, why don't we fix and improve that? But if you watch the election in Kentucky, if you draw any conclusion from Beshear's apparent victory, it's that I think people want to they want to move forward incrementally. They don't want some radical transformation of the economy in ways that we have no idea.
So that's
going to
be my question.
Out.
You travel a lot, though. Do you feel like within the Democratic Party that this is going to that Elizabeth Warren is going to win the game here?
Andrew, I think the overwhelming political fact in America today is that more than half of Americans feel they don't have a candidate they're excited about to vote for in the next election. That includes moderate Republicans, independents, and suburban women, and a lot of, I would call, you know, pro-business Democrats like myself. I think there's just a lot of people feel unrepresented, and I don't think that's sustainable. Somebody's going to fill that vacuum.
Tom, if you believe that a public option would actually save money and spend less, see, my point is it seems like a kind of an obvious narrative. You don't have to earn a profit.
Right.
You don't have all these other things that private
advertising
companies
have to do.
But then the whole reason that the private sector seems more efficient in allocating capital is because there has to be more oversight. You actually have to watch your P's and Q's.
Right.
And if you believe the public option really would be cheaper and save money, then go for it. Go for the whole thing that way. Mm-hmm. If you really believe that, don't go piecemeal. Don't just try. And I think we've had some tests of the public option, whether it's the VA or whatever, even the fraud that we see still perpetrated in Medicare. Right. I'm not sure you do. I think the private sector insurance would win over a public. Right. I don't think you would see that the public option is a better.
It's a legitimate question, I think, Joe. And I think I wouldn't start with a massive public. I think we need to iterate. We need to experiment.
Try it, we'll try it one more time, see if we can get it right this time.
Maybe.
Get the public sector. It won't be the DMV of healthcare.
Maybe. Let's just see. I think it's worth experimenting. You know, there are a lot of experiments in Obamacare that have not, around cost controls also, that were not implemented.
Tom, but I just want to go back to, you said you thought someone there would fill this void, this middle ground. And I'm just sitting around, looking around, going, who? Who is that person?
Unless you think Elizabeth Warren is going to pivot. When she
Which
clinches,
I wonder about. But,
when she clinches the nomination.
Or be unable to do anything that she really wants to do.
That's
I've seen so many Democrats tell me that, she'll be.
To your point, but let me give you what may seem like a strange analogy. But so I watched the Israeli-Palestinian conflict very closely because I found that over time it is to the wider trends in civilization what off-Broadway is to Broadway. Okay, you see things in miniature there. So I'm always asking, what's playing off Broadway? You know, airline hijacking scaled there, suicide bombing scaled there, a wall started there. A lot of things start there and go to Broadway. So what's just been playing off Broadway? They just had two elections in about 6 months. And the last one was very revelatory, I believe. Number one, Netanyahu ran an openly racist, divisive campaign against Israeli Arabs. And Israeli Arabs in the second election said, you talking to me? And they went out and voted in record numbers and created the third largest party in Israel, number one. Number two, Netanyahu was everywhere, on Twitter, on Facebook. He was there all the time. His opponent, Benny Gantz, people were putting a mirror under his nose saying, Benny, are you breathing? Bibi's eating you alive on Facebook and Twitter. And turned out Israelis got sick of it. And actually, 250,000 Israelis changed their vote between the first election and the second. Third thing that happened, Netanyahu ran this divisive. Benny Gantz's opponent ran on national unity. I'm not going to offer you the peace process now, folks. I'm not going to offer some radical plan. I just want to pull the country together. So I find it, as a distant mirror, very interesting what's been playing off Broadway. And therefore, I think someone comes with a very simple message. I want to pull the country together.
Right.
I want to improve health care. I want to work on Obamacare. And I want to focus on education. It's a little bit what Bashir was doing down there in Kentucky. I think that person could do very well.
But pop out a name.
Buttigieg.
You think Buttigieg could?
Yeah. I think he's someone who's... I tell you, I like the way he talks, Andrew, in this way. I like the way he talks about faith. I like the way he talks about his faith. I like the way he talks about abortion. There is a sensitivity to him that and an intelligence that I find very, I don't know him, never met him, but I find very compelling. You know, there's a lot of America that says grace every evening. And I think we should remember that. And sometimes liberals forget that. And I think he's someone who in time, I think, could catch on.
So
yes,
saying,
he's young.
You're saying in time. That's
the
thing.
And I don't know, John, but I'm saying that.
Top of the ticket?
Don't know. And I know all the liabilities, but look, we just had an African-American president and Donald Trump.
The liabilities I mean, he's got far fewer than...
We broke all the molds, as far as I'm concerned.
The one and only Tom Friedman, thank you.
Great to be with you guys.
Great to be with you.
Teasing next.
Next on Squawk Pod.
The food delivery wars are hotter than ever. You know what I saw yesterday? A Grubhub bicyclist. Those guys are nuts. They're nuts. They don't wait for lights. They don't. It's dangerous. Anyway, and one player in an already crowded field is looking to come to the public market, but is now the right
time.
I use
this service, like, constantly to get Sweetgreen.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod. Delivery. We all do it. And most of us use more than one app. At least we do here at Squawk Pod. The only publicly traded pure food delivery service is Grubhub. The other players like DoorDash, Uber Eats, and Postmates have given that platform a run for its money. Literally. Grubhub has lost more than half its market share so far in 2019. That means the other services I just mentioned are catching up. Postmates filed for its IPO confidentially in February and was supposed to publicly file its prospectus, the Wall Street alarm that a company is about to go public, in September. Instead, it closed an additional $225 million funding raise, and in so doing, further delayed its public debut. So not as exciting as an IPO, but certainly newsworthy. The new infusion of cash brings Postmates' valuation up to $2.4 billion. Here's Andrew kicking off with Bastian Lehman, the Postmates CEO.
We're thrilled to have you here this morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very good. I want to talk about the business and where it's headed, but I also want to talk a little bit about the private markets versus public markets and the way people are feeling about valuations for a lot of these businesses, in large part because we've seen the valuations, obviously, for an Uber and a Lyft that have come public, come down, frankly. And so many of them, Uber specifically, are now in your business and losing a ton of money trying to you're trying to eat their lunch and they're trying to eat your lunch. But how do you see the valuation piece before we get to the actual business component right now?
Look, I think for Postmates specifically, you know, having a high valuation was never one of the problems that I had to deal with. Our valuation, I think, increased very slowly over the years. You know, I was never in a situation to receive $1 billion in funding from SoftBank. So maybe that has to do with it, and maybe that's part of it. But we feel very confident where our valuation is right now.
In terms of, I don't know if you can. Can you speak about when this IPO may or may not come?
Look, sometimes good things take a while. You know, we had a window earlier in the year, but you know, after somewhat lukewarm reception of tech companies, right, specifically after WeWork and their large losses, I think we're ready to go when we feel that the market conditions are right. We don't need access to capital right now, so we have the time to figure out when we want to go out.
When you say you have access to capital right now, how long? I mean, given both the growth but also the costs that are involved right now, how long can you go without raising any new capital?
Oh, to profitability.
To profitability, meaning you don't think you have to ever raise additional capital?
We will, and I don't think that is the least intelligent thing to do. Right. But we can operate and would operate the company to get to profitability if we decide to.
So that's the other question, though. So many of these companies, including Uber, have actually dialed back really their growth plans, in large part because the market is forcing them to, in terms of the costs and taking on losses. Are you changing your strategy?
I think it's slightly different. I'm not sure if the market is forcing Uber or Uber Eats unit right to do so. I think you saw in 2019 a year where a lot of players spend against customers. And, you know, there are times in a market when the market dynamics are there that you want to acquire customers. Postmates, DoorDash were the companies that grew the fastest in 2019. Others grew a little bit slower. But there are times for spending, and there are times when you rein in spending.
How many can there be? And by the way, I should say, I use Postmates. I was just telling him because I try to get a Kale Caesar. I know that I'm just feeding.
Dressing on the side.
Kale Caesar dressing on the side.
I said
from
kale.
From Sweet Green.
Because you said
and
it,
I get it on Postmates.
Hold the croutons.
I said kale and I was right.
And I do hold the croutons. But actually, there are no croutons on the kale Caesar. It comes with Parmesan chips. Anyway.
Any protein?
There's chicken in there.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit.
You need some protein.
There's a little carbon footprint associated with that.
My question is, how many of these services do you think can really exist in the ecosystem, given the network effects?
A couple of things. There will be consolidation at some point in the space. But I believe the right way to think about the space is not a winner-take-all market. I like to think about it more like the media streaming world. You will have different brands in this space that appeal to very different customer bases based on the merchants that they provide access to. Right. I'll give you an example. Of course, Postmates skews very much towards millennials. In LA, for example, where we're the undisputed market leader, more than 100% market share, then the number two, over 20% of our orders now come from exclusives. And these are not QSRs. We're focusing on local favorites that you would switch the app for. Right. So think about it like the programming equivalent in the media streaming world. That's how I like to think about this space.
So you are curating who is on your platform. You think that is your competitive advantage?
Curation and giving access to merchants that you would switch an app for. Yes.
Okay. Taco Bell?
So
it's not an exclusive that we have on the platform. I also believe that QSRs are misguided if they do exclusives with one or two players.
He happens to be a Taco Bell lover.
If you do any exclusive, that would be one I'd suggest.
Right. I'll bring it back to the team.
Okay.
Do you feel any difference after Grubhub reported and it was received so poorly on the street, and then there was this narrative that came about from that warning that people are not, they're not loyal to the platform. They're loyal to the restaurants. And so to the extent that you said 22% of your restaurants are exclusive, that the rest of it is not exclusive. Those are all customers that can come and go.
Look, a couple of things. I think Grubhub sent a shareholder letter they should have sent 1 or 2 years ago. I personally think the writing was on the wall ever since we started Postmates 8, 9 years ago, and a new breed of companies entered this field, right? If you read the shareholder letter and you see what Grubhub is talking about, they're saying they see no leverage in the business, right? Well, Barnes & Noble didn't see any leverage in the logistics of shipping books either. See what happened to Blockbuster. We've been there before. The idea that bad management equals a bad market is a shoe that doesn't fit the new breed of companies.
So this is just a Grubhub problem.
100%.
It's not an industry problem.
Can you just speak to, you mentioned consolidation. You said ultimately there should be consolidation in this space. How do you think about that now in terms of your own future as an independent company versus a consolidator or consolidatee?
Look, we don't think about it on a day-to-day basis. We operate a business that will be a very sustainable business that will be in many cities in the U.S. and hopefully around the world, and that's what we're focused on.
Okay. We're going to leave the conversation there. It's very good to see you.
Great seeing you, too.
And we'll order some food, maybe. Get some breakfast.
Postmates some breakfast.
I'll get the Kale Caesar. I'll get you something from Taco Bell.
I think they have something.
I think Grubhub handles Taco Bell.
Do you know who handles Taco Bell?
I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know. Okay, fair enough.
We can find out. You can stonewall all you want. We'll find out.
Let's get to the bottom of it together.
That's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
I certainly don't know what a $3,000 bottle of wine tastes like. Do you?
No.
Is there any universe?
I'm good with $2 chuck. I'm good with $2 chuck.
Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. We don't care where you listen, we just want you to listen to Squawk Pod. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
Woohoo!